Chapter 9. They had set out from Karlskrona on a dirty night, taking anxiety with them and leaving anxiety behind, an anxiety perhaps harder to bear since the Admiral and his political colleague could do nothing but wait for the event of the exceedingly important transactions taking place on the far side of the Baltic. They returned in the early afternoon of a charming day, transports, prize, humbug and all ghosting over a light green sea with barely a ripple on it, the warm southern air just far enough abaft the beam to allow all stunsails to stand, so that even the overcrowded, slab-sided troop carriers were a noble sight as they stood in, led by the aerial, in a perfect line astern, each ship a cable's length from her neighbour, with the Minnie bringing up the rear. And they found a different admiral, a younger, jolly man, no longer mordant or severe. The aerial had telegraphed her news from as far as signals could be made out. The flagship had been in a state of cheerful activity ever since, preparing for her guests, and the galley had been entirely taken over by the great man's cook and his mates.
"I knew it! I knew it!"
he said to Mr. Thornton, as they watched the aerial's boat come across.
"I knew the man! I knew what he could do! It is the finest thing! I knew it would be so!"
In the boat itself there was a grave silence. Jack was exhausted, not only by his exertions when the Minnie was aground, by the sleepless nights, by the general wear of spirit during the transfer, and by the writing of his official report, but even more by Colonel Dollestret's extraordinary loquacity. The Colonel spoke no English, but he was fluent, dreadfully fluent, in French, a language in which Jack could at least listen, and in which, mindful of Stephen's warning that their guest must be handled with the greatest care, he had listened for hours and hours, doing his best to follow, and in the rare pauses contributing remarks that might perhaps be appropriate, and which he knew to be French, such as "Holy name of a dog," "Look me that," and "Blue belly." Hours in which Stephen had deserted him to swim in the newly recovered Catalinity of the transports. Now, however, the colonel had fallen mute. Not only was he a dressy man, even in time of peace, but like many soldiers he believed that there was a direct relation between military worth and perfection of uniform. His own had suffered grievously from the Baltic damp. Its amaranth facings were now the colour of the mud at the bottom of a wine barrel, the lace was tarnished, the tassel of one of his boots was gone, and perhaps worst of all, his coat did not bear the marks of his present rank. The telescope had shown him the glittering array aboard the flagship, the scarlet and pipe-clayed marines, the officers in their number one cocked hats, the admiral glorious in blue and gold. And Stephen could see that he was uneasy in his mind, discontented, ready to take offence and to detect a slight. The brooding expression softened a little as the flagship began the salute, the purely personal salute this time, and Stephen saw his godfather counting the guns one after another. 13, and he looked quite pleased. 14, then the 15th due to a grandee or a full admiral, and the colonel nodded gravely. But his expression was still tense, and Stephen knew that it would not relax entirely until he had been welcomed aboard in a manner he thought appropriate, and until he had a good dinner with at least a pint of wine under his shabby sword belt.
"Should I embrace the Admiral?" he whispered.
"I doubt it," said Stephen.
"Lord Peterborough embraced my grandfather," said the Colonel, with a dogged look.
The boat hooked on. A moment's hesitation at the entering ladder, and they were in the midst of high naval ceremony, the wailing of boatswain's calls, the grind, stamp, and clash of marines presenting arms, and here was the Admiral stepping forward with his hand outstretched to greet Captain Aubrey.
"I knew it!" he said. "I knew it would be so! I knew what you could do!"
"You are very good, sir," said Jack. "But I did little more than stand off and on. The credit," he added in a lower tone and with a significant look, "lies in quite another place. Now, sir, permettez-moi de... how shall I put it? Présenter?" suggested the Admiral. "Thank you, sir. Présenter Don de la Stret, l'Amiral Samarez."
The Admiral swept off his hat. The Colonel spread his arms. After the very slightest pause, and to the unspeakable gratification of the quarterdeck, the Admiral embraced him on both cheeks, assured him with great truth and sincerity that he was very happy to see him aboard, and invited him to dinner. All this in a French somewhat more current than Jack's, and certainly less hideous than the Colonel's, for the Admiral was a Guernsey man. Yet although his tongue was French, his stomach was English, and the Colonel was faced with a dinner that would scarcely have been out of place at the Mansion House. Much of it was very strange to him, and much more was inedible for a Papist, this being Friday. But he was at the Admiral's right hand. He had precedence over a visiting Swedish officer of equal rank, and he steered his way between damnation and ill manners with great good humour, eating the root vegetables and green stuff untainted by flesh, concealing as much meat as possible, and staying himself with bread and wine, drinking glass for glass with the Admiral, though the Admiral was twice his weight. At the other end of the table, Mr. Thornton was telling Stephen of their anguish of spirit during the Ariel's absence, an anguish made all the more poignant by the arrival of a cutter at dawn with the intelligence that General Mercier had embarked in the Minnie.
"You talk of anxiety," said Jack, catching the word during a pause in the happy laughter either side of him. "But how would you like to be answerable day and night for a fragile, costly affair, the property of the King, perpetually at risk, in season and out? There is anxiety for you, I believe. We sea officers are much to be pitied."
"Hear him, hear him!" said his neighbours.
"You young fellows may prate about your cares," said the Admiral, "but what would you say if we had a squadron on your hands? You cannot conceive—" "But I was forgetting, Aubrey. You had the Mauritius command, so you know what it is. Yet even so, you can have no conception of the jading worry of settling a Baltic convoy, 500 or 600 sail of merchantmen, even 1,000 just before the ice stops navigation, and almost nothing to convoy them with. No, no, you are very well as you are, going quietly about your concerns, gathering all the glory and most of the prize money."
Their respect for the Admiral was such that at any other time this might have passed, but now there was a general atmosphere of holiday and relaxation and cheerfulness, and the Admiral's good wine had been going round and round. Passionate dissent broke out. There was no prize money in the Baltic, and by the infamous new regulation that nothing was most scandalously divided. The captains had lost a whole eighth, and that eighth was most absurdly minced up and given to people who only played ducks and drakes with it, their share being so small, while the captains were reduced to abject poverty.
"Never mind, gentlemen," said the Admiral. "There is still glory to be picked up in the Baltic. Look at Aubrey here, as far as you can see him, for his fresh laurels. And in any case, who cares about filthy lucre?"
Some of the captains looked as though they cared very much indeed, and one even observed "non olet" in an undertone. But when the Admiral called down the table to his flag lieutenant, desiring him to "tip us, heart of oak," they listened to the young man's pure tenor with great approval as he sang, "Come cheer up, my lads, 'tis the glory we steer," and they joined in the chorus. "Heart of oak are our ships, heart of oak are our men, we always are ready, steady, boys, steady," with a fine growling roar, the last deep steady making the wine ripple in the decanters.
"We are singing about glory, sir," said the Admiral to Colonel Dullestrett. "There is no better subject for a song," said the Colonel, "far more suitable than whining about some woman. I am a great friend to glory and to song. With your permission, I will sing you one about Lord Peterbugger and my grandfather when they took Barcelona together, the most glorious feat of united British and Catalan arms."
The song was quite remarkably well received. Indeed, the whole afternoon passed off very pleasantly, not only in the flagship, but aboard the transports too, where ring within ring of Catalans danced the sardana on the forecastle to the sound of oboes and a little drum, while during the intervals the foremast hands showed them the finer points of the hornpipe.
"Lord Stephen," said Jack, when they had returned to the Ariel, "I do not know that I have ever been so sleepy. I shall turn in as soon as we have unmoored."
"Surely we are not to set off again without a pause, for all love?"
"Eh?
Are we to set off at once? And on a Friday, too?"
"Yes, of course we are. You said yourself that the sooner they were repatriated, the better. The Admiral and the Politico quite agreed. So here it is in my orders. You had better look at them. They speak of you. And as for its being Friday, I don't believe in omens any more. Not after this last caper.
"We really might be a parcel of wandering Jews," said Stephen in a discontented voice. He took the orders and observed, "This seems to be a somewhat petulant insistence upon command and authority here. After so agreeable and, shall I say, matey afternoon, I should have looked for my dear Aubrey, rather than his cold and peremptory sir. And surely the whole tenor is arrogant, devoid of common amenity, calculated to arouse a spirit of indignant revolt. Sir, you are hereby required and directed to proceed without a moment's loss of time in His Majesty's ship under your command, together with the ships and vessels named in the margin, to Hanno Bay, where you will find a convoy under the protection of His Majesty's ships. I wish humbug had been among them. Such pompous, hectoring, tautologous, semi-literate stuff. You will leave the convoy when you reach the broad 14s, and make your way with the utmost diligence to the Bordeaux stream, where you may expect to find His Majesty's ship Eurydice for intelligence of the situation in the Bight of Biscay. Failing her, you will proceed to Santandero or Passages for the same purpose, and in all matters having to do with the landing of the Spanish troops you will follow the advice of Dr. S. Maturin, who alone is to determine, seek his guidance on the opportunity of Marquis of Wellington, submit to his judgment. A man of any spirit would be more inclined to toss S. Maturin into the sea than to ask his advice after this. Spanish troops, forsooth. He had been aware for some time that Jack was asleep, but he maundered on until Hyde came in with the news that the aerial's signal to proceed to sea was flying aboard the flagship. Light airs all night, wafting the aerial and her charges south and westward through a gathering haze, her captain, as it were, stunned in the ultimate depth of sleep. Towards 5 o'clock he began to snore, a profound, deliberate, rhythmic sound that filled the cabin. "Ah, your soul to the devil, Jack," said Stephen, making an ineffectual lunge towards his cot. The snoring continued. Stephen thrust the wax balls deeper into his ears, but no bee had yet made the wax that would keep Captain Aubrey out, and presently Stephen left his bed in despair. A little after the changing of the watch, the noise stopped, and Jack sat up, wholly alive and conscious. It was not the noise of the ship's bell that woke him, for it had been tolling all night, ever since they entered the fog, with a musket shot every 2 minutes, nor the sound of the swabs and the holy stones, which were something of a lullaby to him, nor yet the light of day, there being so very little of it, but rather the working of some calculating machine within that had sensed the shifting of the wind, both in force and direction, and plotting these against the variations in the ship's course, with allowance for leeway and indraft, now informed him that they had opened Hanno Bay. He sat up, saw that Stephen's cot was empty, opened the slide of the dark lantern, looked at the telltale compass overhead, looked at the barometer, still sinking steadily, silently drew on his clothes and crept out, moving with great caution in case he should wake Colonel de Lestrette, who, the little ship being so crowded, slept in the dining cabin, an ever-present menace. On deck he could scarcely see beyond the bowsprit, but he heard the convoy at once, a remote braying of conches, the sound of bells, the occasional musket, and far off the thump of the escort's signal gun, the senior captain keeping his flock together. He exchanged good mornings with the pilot and the officer of the watch, noticed that although the courses and topsails hung slack from their yards, the invisible t'gallants must be drawing, since the ship made more than steerage way, and looking at the logboard, saying,
"Well, Mr. Pelworm, how long do you think it will last?"
"Well, sir," said the pilot, "I reckon it will burn off with the sun, but I don't quite like the way the glass keeps dropping. I dare say it will start to blow from the north presently, and then back into the west. And with all this here convoy, the Langland's belt is none too wide."
Some freak of the air brought a passionate skipper's cry.
"If you foul my hawse, I'll cut your cable, you hulking Dutch-built bugger!"
as clear as if he had been only 100 yards off, instead of far along the bay. And immediately afterwards Stephen's voice floated down from the upper regions to say that if Captain Aubrey chose to come up, he would see a most remarkable sight. He might make the ascent quite easily and safely by the ropes on the left, on the larboard side looking forward.
"What the devil did you let him get up there for?"
said Jack, frowning upon Mr. Fenton.
"He must be at the cross-trees."
And pitching his voice aloft,
"Hold fast! Do not move! I am with you this minute!"
"Oh, I'm very sorry, sir," said Fenton. "They said they were just going into the top. Mr. Jagiello is with them."
"You might perhaps term it a Hapax phenomenon," said Stephen.
"Hapax phenomenon,"
muttered Jack, climbing fast. They were not at the cross-trees. By some miracle they had managed to reach the topgallant yard and to crawl out on it. There they stood, their feet upon the horses, their hands grasping various ropes, leaning over the yard, very much at their ease. Physically very much at their ease, with Stephen positively gay. Jagiello, however, was far less cheerful than usual.
"There!" cried Stephen, when Jack appeared in the frail topgallant shrouds. "Are you not amazed?"
He pointed cautiously with one finger, and Jack looked out to the southwest. At this height they were above the low blanket of fog that covered the sea. Clear sky above, no water below. No deck even, but a smooth layer of white mist, sharply cut off from the clean air. And ahead, on the starboard bow and on the starboard beam, the surface of the soft, opaque whiteness was pierced by an infinity of masts, all striking up from this unearthly ground into a sky without a cloud, a sky that might have belonged to an entirely different world.
"Are you not amazed?"
he said again. Jack was ordinarily a good-natured man, but today he had not breakfasted, and in any case the sight of his friend trusting his life to an unstoppered signal halyard was more than he could bear. He roared,
"On deck! Belay the signal halyard! Belay everything that belongs to the main topgallant!"
and said,
"Amazed and gratified, Stephen, leave go that rope, clap on to the yard, and come in towards the tie. I will guide your feet."
"Oh,"
said Stephen, giving a galvanic leap and throwing his arms about, "I'm not at all nervous. Now that I cannot see the deck, it is as though the height were abolished. I'm not at all nervous, I assure you. But tell me, have you ever beheld such a sight?"
"Not above a few hundred times," said Jack. "We call it the day blink. It often happens when the breeze lies just so, or dies away. It will clear as soon as the sun is well up. But I am grateful for having been called aloft before breakfast to see it again. Put your foot here, round the stirrup. You have fouled the stirrup. Your shoe is foul of the mouse. Mr. Jagiello, leave that becket alone. Stephen, give me your hand. Handsomely now, handsomely does it."
At this point Stephen dropped abruptly from the yard. Not perpendicularly, however, for Jack's powerful arm swung him inwards to the cap, while the shoe continued its free fall to the deck.
"Thank you, Jack,"
he said, gasping as he was settled on the cross-trees with a turn about his middle.
"I am obliged to you. I must have made a false movement."
"Perhaps you did,"
said Jack. "But what in God's name are you doing up here anyway? Jagiello, leave that becket alone. You know I have begged you both not to go above the top."
"The fact of the matter is that Mr. Jagiello is in an embarrassing position."
"He will be in kingdom come if you don't leave go that becket. Mr. Jagiello, leave go that becket. Clap on to the robins with both hands and come into the big block in the middle."
"We could not discuss it on the deck. Since the people kept desiring us to move out of the swabber's way, so we went up to the top. But there again buckets of water were flinging about, so we climbed still higher. He has found a woman in his bed."
"Just so, just so," said Jack.
"Mr. Fenton, secure the doctor's shoe."
"Yes, sir,"
said Jagiello, who had worked his way to the back brace and whose blushing face now peered down at them.
"I found her there when I went to my cabin just now."
"What have you been doing all night?"
"I had been playing cards in the gunroom with the Catalan officers."
"And I collect that she is not wanted on the voyage?"
"Oh, no, sir. Not at all."
It occurred to Jack that this was a very ridiculous place for a conference of such a nature, with the two landsmen poised in awkward postures between heaven and earth, and himself deprived of his breakfast. He called down,
"Mr. Fenton! Send me up a couple of prime upper yardmen with a snatch block and line for a whip."
While they were coming, Stephen said in a low voice,
"There, it is almost gone. And yet in its prosaic way this is almost as striking."
The mist, lifting and dissolving with the first rays of the sun, showed 783 vessels, all merchantmen except for one frigate, the old Juno, three sloops of war, and a cutter.
"Never have I had so strong an impression of the vast magnitude of seaborne trade, of mercantile enterprise, of the interdependence of nations."
"There is our house," said Jack, nodding towards a town, now clear on the shore of the bay. "The lady will take her breakfast on dry land. Mr. Fenton, lower down the gig."
The top men came running up, one of them bearing Stephen's shoe. Jack cast a loop round his waist, made all fast, bade him hold on to the knot, called,
"Lower handsomely,"
and Stephen made his ignominious descent, as he had often done before. Jagiello followed him, and then Jack, broad grins on the quarter-deck and a lively air of expectation.
"Now, Mr. Jagiello,"
said Jack,
"you must signify to the lady that she is to be over the side in 2 minutes. There is not a moment to be lost."
"If you please, sir," said Jagiello, blushing to the eyes, "I had rather not. It would seem so unkind, and it would take so very long. Tears, you know, and reclamations. Perhaps Mr. Pellworm would be so infinitely obliging. He knows her, and he speaks the Swedish. Mr. Pellworm is a married man."
"You are acquainted with the lady, Mr. Pellworm?"
"From afar, sir, from afar. I have seen the young person from afar. Who has not, that has ever put into Karlskrona and attended the theatre? I may have spoken to her once or twice just to pass the time of day, as I did when she came aboard, but only when I was with officers, the young person being known to one and all, to all and sundry, sir, as the gentleman's relish, and I hope I know my station. Besides, I'm told she is now the governor's private piece, a singing harlot of enormous price, in the words of the poet. But if you wish me to turn her ashore, sir, I will speak to her now. Speak to her like a Dutch uncle."
"Aye, pray do, Mr. Pellworm," said Jack. "A man of war is no place for women."
Pellworm nodded, and he walked off with a heavy tread, composing his face into a severe, determined, and even brutal expression. A singing harlot she might be, but it was in a singularly harsh and unmusical voice that she addressed the aerial from over the water as the stolid, reliable, middle-aged forecastle hands rowed her ashore.
"What does she say?" asked Stephen. "Loins as hot as a goat, heart as cold as a stone," said Pellworm. "That is poetry, too." "It is not true. She knows nothing whatever about my loins, has never seen them," cried Jagiello from his lurking place on the far side of the mizzenmast. He added, "I never invited her, and I begged her to go away."
"If only all these problems could be resolved so easily,"
murmured Jack, as he watched the gentleman's relish growing smaller and smaller.
"Mr. Fenton, we may edge down on the Juno and pick up the gig on the way."
Stephen glanced at him and at Jagiello.
"Poltroons," he said to himself, "scrubs."
And looking along the deck, he noticed that apart from a few grinning, ill-conditioned men and boys, most of the hands looked ashamed and concerned.
"It is a very curious thing," said Jack to Stephen over breakfast, "but I learned that Jagiello went ashore while we were aboard the Flag, and he had not been back above half an hour before three young women put off to the ship. Two were the Swedish Admiral's daughters, amazingly pretty, says Hyde, and the third was the relish, who kills at a mile. But what I cannot for the life of me understand is what they see in him. He is a good fellow, to be sure, but he is only a boy. I doubt he shaves once a week, if that. And indeed, he is rather more like a girl than anything else."
"So it seems was Orpheus, but that did not prevent women from tearing him limb from limb. His head, his beardless head, floated down the swift Hebrus, together with his broken lyre, alas."
"Oh, my God, here is the colonel,"
said Jack, grasping his cup and a piece of toast and hurrying on deck. It was here that he spent most of the day, for a thin drizzle succeeded the mist, keeping the colonel below, and although the convoy was not due to sail until the evening, the Juno asked Jack to take up a station ahead of the main body, and moving the aerial and her transports through this vast crowd of shipping with light and variable airs, took a very long time, the more so as many of the merchantmen lay in a curiously haphazard and whimsical fashion, as though their masters could not tell starboard from larboard, hay from straw. The captain and the colonel met for dinner, however, when the gunroom invited them to a noble spread, and when Jack endured the purgatory of an hour or so of French, mostly, as far as he could tell, about the fine women who had pursued Dullestrett, regiments of women, it seemed, married and unmarried, with some very pathetic cases among them. The last arrivals joined the convoy from Riga, bringing up a fine breeze from the northeast. The Juno anxiously counted her charges, signalling with scarcely a pause, receiving meaningless or contradictory replies, emphasising her orders with guns, sending her boats hither and thither to convey her captain's wishes by roaring word of mouth. Yet the regulation of even so vast a convoy had an end at last, and eventually the Juno gave the word to weigh. Thousands and thousands of sails appeared, lightening the grey air over the whole spacious bay, and they moved off in three amorphous divisions, gliding gently into the night at the speed of the slowest, an ill-conceived, undermanned, over-insured Pink from Cork. The divisions were sadly scattered by dawn, in spite of the lights they all carried in their tops. But the good northeaster enabled them to gather in some semblance of order, and carried them briskly through the difficult Fehmarn Channel by sunset, when it abruptly chopped into the south and became a perfect leading wind for the still more difficult Langlands Belt. They threaded the long channel in the night, scarcely touching a sheet or brace, and from the shore they looked like some prodigious constellation, enormously rich in stars, that had strayed to the surface of the sea. They sailed with a wind that kept the hostile gunboats in port, and the only untoward event was a Dane's diabolical attempt at insinuating himself into the procession in the hope of carrying a straggler by surprise and darting into Spodsbjerg with her. But he was detected. The signal for a stranger in the fleet brought the hindmost sloop of war tearing up from the rear, and although the Dane did indeed dart into Spodsbjerg, he darted alone, with tattered sails and five gaping holes between wind and water, leaving no more damage behind him than three merchantmen that had fallen aboard one another in their alarm, and that had to be taken in tow. But this happened at midnight, and so far back in the immensely long convoy that the Ariel was hardly aware of it. When the grey, weeping dawn began to light the greyer sea, the van was already far out into the Great Belt itself, with Zealand faintly looming on the starboard beam, and Funan lost in the distant rain to port.
"Well, Mr. Pelworm,"
said Jack, shaking the wet from his pea jacket and looking up at the cloud racing up from the south with strong approval,
"I'm afraid you are disappointed of your wind out of the north."
"I'm not complaining, sir," said Pelworm. "As pretty a breeze, as pretty a passage as you could wish. The answer to a maiden's prayer, as the poet says, and I dare say it will carry us right up the Kattegat. But mark my words, sir, mark my words, we shall have our blow yet, and I only hope we may have weathered the score before it starts. You cannot set sail on a Friday, the 13th of the month, with a woman on board into the bargain, without you have a blow. I'm not in the least superstitious. I leave crows and pies crossing my path and cards and tea leaves and such to Mrs. Pelworm, but it stands to reason that what seamen have found to be the case ever since the memory of man saith not to the contrary, must have something in it. There is no smoke without a fire. Besides, the glass is dropping yet, and even if it were not, a Friday is always a Friday."
"Maybe, maybe. But a good many of these omens are all cry and no wolf."
"Is it not wool, sir?"
"Come, come, Mr. Pelworm," said Jack, laughing aloud. "Who would cry wool too often? What would be the point of crying wool? There is no danger in wool, you know. Indeed, London Bridge is founded on it, and you cannot say fairer than that, I believe. No, no, your omens keep threatening disaster. They did so before Grimsholm, and you see what happened? All cry with no wolf at the end of it. I've done with omens," he said, grasping a belaying pin. "But your falling glass is another kettle of fish. Your glass is scientific."
Pelworm's face took on a dogged expression, and he said,
"As you please, sir. But there are more things in heaven and earth, Captain Aubrey, than you philosophers dream of."
"Philosophers, Mr. Pelworm?"
"Oh, sir, that was only poetry. I meant no disrespect."
"Philosophers, Mr. Pelworm,"
began Jack, but he broke off at the sight of the Ariel's master, who was approaching the first lieutenant on the leeward side of the quarterdeck with small, constrained steps, consternation all over his face and his hands clasped in front of him.
"What's amiss, Mr. Grimmond?" he cried.
"Sir," said Grimmond in an unnatural voice, "I am very sorry to have to report that the timepiece is broke. I dropped it on the deck."
He opened his hands, and there, nestling in his handkerchief, lay the wreck of the Ariel's chronometer. It had had the unluckiest fall, striking its most vulnerable joint on a ring bolt, and now its works lay all abroad. There was little point in asking the master why he was looking at the chronometer at this time of day, far from the regulation time for winding it, or how he came to drop it. And although these questions at once presented themselves, together with the observation that one should always take very great care when handling anything so delicate, Jack only said,
"Well, well, my hack watch is fairly accurate, though now I come to think on it, the doctor's is a great deal better."
To the doctor he said,
"Stephen, a damn thing has happened. The timepiece is broke. Will you lend me your watch?"
"You are welcome to it," said Stephen, producing his severely beautiful Breguet. "But what is wrong with the other chronometers?"
"There ain't any other chronometers."
"Come, brother, I remember to have seen a whole array in our various ships, and distracted young gentlemen trying to find the mean of them all while you bullied them, holding your hack watch in one hand and peering at the celestial bodies with the other."
"Yes, but that was because I have always had my own, ever since I could afford it, and if a captain buys one, the Admiralty lets him have two more. Otherwise he carries just the single timekeeper, and then only if he is going foreign in most cases."
"The machine is used for finding out the latitude, I believe."
"To tell you the truth, Stephen, most people rely on the sextant for their latitude. The timekeeper is more for the other thing, east and west, you know."
"East and west of what, for all love?"
"Why, of Greenwich, naturally."
"I am no great navigator," said Stephen.
"You are far too modest," said Jack,
"though I have often wondered how you mariners find your way about the dank wastes of ocean. But from what you tell me, I see that for your countrymen, Greenwich rather than Jerusalem is the navel of the universe. Lo, Greenwich, where many a shrew is in. Ha ha! And secondly, that whereas a poor man can fix his position only with regard to north and south, to up and down, his wealthy brother is secure to right and left as well. There is no doubt a logic in this, although it escapes me, just as the use of the timepiece escapes me, with its peevish insistence upon accuracy in the measurement of what is, after all, a most debatable concept, quite unknown, we are told, in heaven. Tell me, is it really capable of telling you where you are, or is this just another of your naval, I must not say superstitions, like saluting the purely hypothetical crucifix on the quarterdeck?"
"If you have exact Greenwich time aboard, if you carry it with you, you can fix your longitude exactly by accurate observation of local noon, to say nothing of occultations and the finer points. I have a pair of Arnolds at home, how I wish I had brought 'em, that only gained 20 seconds from Plymouth to Bermuda. In these waters that would tell you where you were, east or west, to within 3 miles or so. Oh, the Lunarians may say what they please, but a well-tempered chronometer is the sweetest thing. Suppose you were riding along with your watch set to Greenwich time in your pocket, and suppose you happened to take a noon observation and found that the sun southed at 12:05, you would know that you were almost exactly on the meridian of Winchester, without having to search for a finger-post. And the same applies to the sea, where finger-posts are tolerably uncommon."
"Heavens, Jack, what things you tell me! And I dare say this would answer for, let us say, Dublin and Galway?"
"I should not care to affirm anything about Ireland, where people have the strangest notion of time. But at sea, I do assure you, it answers very well. That is why I should like to borrow your watch."
"Alas, my poor friend, not only is it set to Karlskrona time, but it loses a minute or so a day. And from what you tell me, that would represent a span of some 20 miles. I am afraid we must imitate the ancients and hug the shore, creeping from promontory to promontory."
"I very much doubt the ancients did anything of the kind. Can you imagine anyone in his wits coming within sight of a lee shore? Oh, no, blue water sailing for me. And after all, the old uns found their way to the New World and back again with no more than lead latitude and lookout. Even so, a watch true to a minute would be useful in case of dirty weather. I shall signal Juno and set it by their reckoning."
He cocked his ear to the sound of Colonel Dillestret singing Bon Coup de Valse as he shaved in preparation for his first appearance, a harsh, disagreeable voice, not unlike Stephen's, and went on,
"Though now I come to think on it, I believe I shall go across. Maudsley owes me a mutton chop."
"The Colonel would be disappointed not to see you at dinner. Besides, the sea is rough, the day inclement."
"Nelson once said that love of his country served him for a greatcoat. It is my clear duty to pull across whatever the weather and take an accurate reading. You will make my excuses. As an officer, the Colonel will certainly understand. Besides, you can invite Jagiello. Jagiello will entertain him. He speaks French quite as well as I do. Yes, that is the very thing. You must ask Jagiello to dinner."
Captain Aubrey had a rough trip of it on his way to the Juno. He had an even rougher, wetter return, and although he was buoyed up with Maudsley's capital dinner, there were times when he and the coxswain and every man in the boat thought he had misjudged it. That the ugly, short cross-seas cut up by the strengthening wind as it backed must swamp them. As it was, the launch was very near stove alongside, and when Jack came aboard in his dripping, borrowed boat cloak, he caught the pilot's eye fixed upon him with a look of triumph.
"Well, Mr. Pellworm," he said, "here is your blow at last. But at least I hope it has come late enough to let us weather the score."
"Oh, I hope so too, sir, I'm sure,"
said Pellworm, obviously convinced that they should do nothing of the kind.
"But it is backing uncommon fast, and once it comes full north, farewell, adieu."
"That bloody-minded old Pellworm," said Jack, as he changed into what few dry garments he possessed. "He would rather we beat to and fro for a week, trying to get out of the sleeve, and then after all having to stretch away to lie in Kungsbacker to wait for a fair wind rather than have his prediction fail. He will bring us bad luck. Mingus," he called to the steward, "take these along to the galley to dry, and take care of the lace as you value your hide. Stephen, I am going to sleep until the setting of the watch. We have a heavy night ahead of us. Where is the Colonel?"
"He is already gone to bed. He finds himself incommoded by the motion, leaves his compliments and excuses, however."
A heavy night they had, but Stephen and Jagiello knew little of it, apart from thumps, hoarse nautical cries, pipings, the muted thunder of feet as the watch below was turned up to make sail or take it in, and the wild swinging of the lantern that lit their little green-topped card table. They had tacitly abandoned chess and taken to piquet. Stephen had always been lucky at cards. Jagiello was quite disastrously and uniformly unfortunate. By three bells in the middle watch he had lost all his money, and since they had agreed to play only for visible coin, the game necessarily came to an end. He looked wistfully at his entire fortune lying there on Stephen's side. 17 shillings and 4p, mostly in very small change. But after a moment his native cheerfulness returned, and he declared that the moment they set foot on land he should cash one of his letters of credit and beg for his revenge.
"That will be next week, I suppose," he said. "Perhaps you may be too sanguine," said Stephen, cutting the ace of spades and then immediately after the ace of hearts. "From what I am told by Mr. Pellworm, an old experienced Baltic pilot, it is more likely to be next year." "But I have heard of the passage made in 4 days. We came very quickly, and the wind is now blowing towards England." "Mr. Pellworm is trying to make our meat creep. He told me the same thing." "Certainly there is a very vicious tendency in Mr. Pellworm and in many other mariners to terrify the landsmen, and to be sure the wind blows from the northeast. But you are to consider that we are not yet out of the sleeve. We have yet to weather the score, and the wind is coming more northward still."
"Oh, indeed," said Jagiello, looking perfectly blank.
"As a cavalry officer," said Stephen, "you have perhaps not fully appreciated the importance, the primordial importance of the breeze in maritime affairs. Even I was not wholly imbued with it until I had been many years at sea. Let us suppose that this 3-shilling piece represents the score, that notorious headland, innocent in appearance but death to ships," he said, placing a coin on the left-hand side of the table. "And this," placing another on the right,
Gothenburg, on the Swedish main, with some 10 leagues between them, and here, with the island of Lesso somewhat behind us, or abaft, as we say, is the convoy, represented by these pennies and halfpence. Now, you must know that a ship's head can be usefully pointed no nearer the wind than 6 points of the compass, or 67.5 degrees, and although she may appear to be travelling that close to the origin of the breeze, in fact her true course is by no means the same, for there is also a lateral motion, execrated by the seamen, known as leeway. This depends on the impetuosity of the billows, and a host of other factors, but I believe I may say that in the present condition it must amount to 2 points. That is to say, we are really moving at right angles to the wind.
"Then all is well," cried Jagiello, "because the wind being in the northeast, we clear the score."
"With all my heart," said Stephen. "But if it moves to the north, if it moves the 4 points between northeast and north, then the other arm of the angle inevitably moves a corresponding distance south, and you will readily perceive that the arm strikes the headland as soon as it has passed through 15 degrees, or considerably less than the 4 points of which I speak. Furthermore, Mr. Jagiello, furthermore, even if we do creep round the score, Mr. Pellworm promises us the wind is likely to shift even west of north, perhaps even into the dreaded west itself, growing more violent as it does so, and once the breeze rises to a gale, the leeway, to which I referred, increases, so that when topsails are obliged to be taken in, or handed, we reckon at least 4 points, so that once we are round the score, we have Jammer Bay under our lee, with the wind blowing directly upon it. We no longer travel at right angles to the wind, but at some 120 degrees from it, gradually slanting towards the hostile coast and its mortal breakers. We may throw out anchors, but there is little confidence to be placed in anchors during a gale of wind. They drag, the ship drives, and in the hours that follow we have ample time to deplore our ineluctable fate, regretting, no doubt, lost opportunities of pleasure, even of reform. Such, Mr. Jagiello, are what a former shipmate of mine called the impervious horrors of a leeward shore. Small wonder that Captain Aubrey regards the coast as being far too near at 20 miles away. A small wonder that Mr. Pellworm, who has seen the ships of a numerous convoy together with 2 great men of war miserably shattered along the reefs of Jammer Bay, should wish to bear up, or down, or away, and run for Kungsbacka. Twice in what was left of the night he heard Jack come below and move quietly about, drinking from the jug of negus, or groping for a piece of Swedish bun. But having fallen into a deep sleep a little after dawn, he did not see him until breakfast. Captain Aubrey's face, though pink and freshly shaved, showed marks of a long, active, anxious night. It was comparatively thin, and he was setting about his meal with a wolfish appetite.
"There you are, Stephen!" he cried. "Good morning to you. I did not look to see you yet a while, and I am sorry to say I have ate the last of the bacon. The dish was empty before I was aware."
"It is always the same old squalid tale," said Stephen. "May I at least hope there is a tint of coffee left?"
"Had you shown a leg sooner, you would have saved your bacon," said Jack. "Ha, ha, ha, Stephen! Did you hear that? Saved your bacon! It came to me in a flash."
"Sure, there is nothing like spontaneous wit," said Stephen, and after a pause, "tell me, what of the night? And how do we stand?"
"It was tolerably rough, but consummate seamanship brought us through, and we just weathered the score in the middle watch, though with precious little to spare. 5 miles at the most."
"So we are round?" said Stephen, rasping his 3 days' beard. He was still stupid from his heavy sleep, the memory of an erotic dream, the first since his renewed acquaintance with Diana, was still strong in his mind. He was a frowsy, unwashed object, his wits not yet gathered into an orderly troop, whereas Jack was in the full tide of daily life.
"Yes, and we are bowling along under all plain sail at a good 7 knots, the breeze at north by east. When you come on deck you will see the Holmes 6 or 7 leagues on the larboard beam. But poor Maudsley had to bear up, with his merchantmen sagging to leeward so. The convoy has run for Kungsbacka."
"Do not tell me the transports have turned back. God forbid. Oh, surely the transports are round.
Of course they are. What a fellow you are, Stephen. How could I have possibly left them in the sleeve? They may not be much to look at, but they are good weatherly ships, and they came round as well as the aerial. Good officer-like captains, too. I shall invite them to dinner as soon as the weather moderates.
So Pellworm's west wind did not eventuate at all?
Not so far, at any rate.
And there was I, telling Jagiello of the perils of a leeward shore with a wealth of technical detail that would have amazed you. Jack smiled. I say the accuracy of my account would have amazed you, said Stephen. And I flatter myself that even you would have found no fault in my description of the long-drawn-out horror of a vessel so situated or entrapped.
I am sure I should not, said Jack gravely. You could not exaggerate it if you tried.
Why I did so, I cannot tell, observed Stephen, more human now that he had absorbed his morning draught. Perhaps it was some obscure derangement of my humours. My intention was certainly malignant. I wished to make him uneasy, to take away from his superabundant cheerfulness. I believe I succeeded. I certainly brought truth and deep conviction to the task. I regret it now.
Never be so concerned. If you frightened him, the effect wore off in the night. I saw him running about on deck before I came below, laughing like a holiday.
What a daedal maze, said Stephen, referring to the workings of his mind, and holding up a piece of toast as he did so. Although I like Jagiello and esteem his parts, there are times when his youth and energy and high spirits and beauty arouse ill feelings in my bosom. It is envy, no doubt, mere base, ignoble, grovelling envy. No gentleman's relish ever pursued me in my youth, nor at any other time.
He is an engaging young fellow, to be sure, but upon my sacred honour I cannot tell what women see in him.
This is the last of the toast, I presume.
I am afraid it is, said Jack, and I am afraid there will be no more soft tack to make it with until we are in the Downs.
When will that be, do you suppose?
If only this breeze holds, in a couple of days, now that we are no longer tied to the slugs of the convoy. But I should not like to answer for the wind. The weather is all a-hoo, the glass skips up and down, and we may have Pellworm's blow upon us yet. Still, if it does not come much south of west, we might strike the Broad 14s on Thursday, and so tide it down the channel.
The weather was indeed all a-hoo, upset, chaotic, unpredictable, and there was a very great deal of it, almost always thick, with winds from northeast and northwest varying from light airs to close-reefed topsail gales, often accompanied by rain and heavy seas. These at least kept the colonel below, but otherwise Jack had a somewhat disagreeable time of it. For one thing, he was frustrated in his wish to invite the captains of the troop carriers, all elderly lieutenants who lacked the influence or the luck of successful action needed for promotion, but all excellent seamen who brought their ships along in a manner he wholeheartedly admired, hardly keeping the aerial back at all. And then, in his reckoning, he had to allow for the curious North Sea indraft, irregular variation of the compass, the lack of observations, and the absence of a chronometer, so that what was ordinarily a simple, routine passage became a long-lasting, anxious test of navigation by instinct, with the devil to pay if his guess proved wrong. Yet not by instinct alone, for although the sky remained impenetrable for most of the time, and the grey waves told him little, the bottom of that shallow sea was a vast mosaic of different colours, and he kept the lead going continually, wet miserable hands in the windward main chains uttering their dismal chant by day and night, and together with Pellworm and the master he continually examined the samples that the tallow on the lead brought up. Grey sand, fine yellow sand with shells, sludge, coarse ground with small black stones, shingle. But the tesserae of this mosaic were often many miles across. The appreciation of their nature varied from man to man, so that the master and the pilot were sometimes in strong disagreement. And there were occasions when Jack was tempted to ask his way of the many fishermen, English and Dutch, who haunted those perilous banks in their shallow draught doggers, skites, busses, hawkers, and even bugalets, and who made his progress all the more uneasy by lying across his hawse until the last possible minute, or suddenly looming out of the darkness without a single light, so that he had to throw all aback. Like most English commanders, Jack never interfered with fishermen, whatever their nationality. And twice he was rewarded by strong Dutch voices out of the gloom, cursing him for a goddamn boggart for having fouled their handlines. As for Stephen's watch, it was an elegant machine, and admirably calculated for taking a pulse, but it asserted that the ship was 10 miles clear of the galloper at a time when they could actually see the lightship guarding the shoal hoist its lanterns in the western murk.
"God send we may not run plump onto the Goodwin," said Jack to the master as the Ariel and her charges hauled their wind and fled to the deep water channel.
"Oh, sir," said Grimmond, who never expected facetiousness from so imposing a figure, "surely that is well to the south."
They were spared the Goodwin, as they had been spared the Haddock Bank, the Leman, the Ower, the Outer Dowsing. Indeed, they ran into the Downs on the one clear morning of the week, and it was just as well that they did so, for the roadstead was crowded with shipping, great convoys for the Indies, east and west, the Mediterranean and the Guinea coast. And if the weather had been as dirty as they had found it these last few days, it would have been difficult to thread through the various fleets. There were few merchantmen setting off on their own, however, in spite of the favourable wind. The French had been unusually busy in the chops of the channel, and it was rumoured that 2 American frigates were lying off the Land's End. The Ariel only paused long enough to hail a Deal pilot boat to set Mr. Pellworm ashore. As he went over the side, he said,
"Mark my words, sir, mark my words. It will come into the west yet, whatever Mr. Grimmond may say, and when it does come it will blow all the harder for the waiting."
He moved 3 steps down the ladder and paused, his eyes just over the rail.
"Sick earth convulsive groans from shore to shore, and nature shuddering feels the horrid roar," he said.
His eyes took on a particularly knowing and significant look for a moment, and then vanished. The quarterdeck frowned. Pellworm might be an old, respected pilot, but this was coming it too high by half. This was taking a liberty with their captain.
"Fill the main topsail," said Jack in a strong, displeased voice, and more privately to Stephen, "I am glad we are shot of Mr. Pellworm. He is an excellent pilot, but he prates too much. Poetry is not at all suitable on the quarterdeck of a man of war, particularly on such a subject. It might make the hands uneasy."
It might also be right. There was perhaps something unpleasant in the smiling sky, and although the breeze seemed firmly settled in the northeast, Jack was determined not to lose a minute of it, but to run down channel with a press of sail until he could round Ushant with plenty of sea room. He would not even stop long enough to take in fresh supplies from the bumboats that came round the ship, observing in his decided manner,
"that they were not here to blow out their kites with lobscouse, nor to choke their luffs with figgy dowdy, but to convey the Catalan troops to Santandero without a moment's loss of time. Dried peas would answer very well until they should reach Santandero."
And with a fresh breeze, a following tide, and a fine sense of urgency, they stood southwest. A fair wind right down the channel was rare enough. Often and often he had had to anchor for the tide, beat up tack upon tack in the narrow seas, winning a few miles only to be driven back again, weeks sometimes before he could get clear into the Atlantic. But now the familiar landmarks filed by in fine, brisk succession, the South Foreland, Dungeness, Fairleigh, and Beachy gleaming through a wall of rain with solid blue-black cloud behind it. And then, late in the evening, there was the white clear on the starboard bow. Jack climbed into the mizzen-top with a telescope, and before the green light vanished in the west, he thought he caught the glint of his observatory dome at Ashgrove Cottage. He stared at it in a strange confusion of spirits, as though at another world, farther from him now than when he had been in the Antipodes. The wind increased with the setting of the sun, and seeing that it would certainly come on to blow, they struck to gallant-masts, reefed topsails, and made all snug, even to the extent of rolling tackles and puddening. Storm canvas had been the order of the day since Jutland, and they passed the start as though they meant to fly out of the channel without once changing course and reach the Spanish coast before the end of the week, a fitting crown to a most uncommon expedition. Once again the dawn broke fair enough after a rainy night, though a heavy swell was setting from the southwest against the wind and tide, sending green water over the Ariel's bows, and they ran past the Eddystone, with Rame Head and the home-like entrance to Plymouth plain beyond it, past the Dodman. And between the Dodman and the Lizard their luck failed them. Without any warning, but three black squalls in quick succession, the wind chopped about into the west, blowing right into their teeth and bringing very heavy rain.
"We were so nearly clear," said Jack. "Another hour and I should have stood south. Such a run it would have been. However, whining will do no good, and at least we have a couple of 100 miles under our lee."
He tied his sou'wester firmly under his chin, advised Stephen to make all fast, and returned to the streaming deck.
"What is amiss?" asked Jagiello. "It is another of these vile headlands," said Stephen. "This one is called Ushant, and we must get round it. We must weather it to clear the channel and reach the Biscay shore."
"There are too many of these headlands at sea," said Jagiello. "Give me a horse any day."
Jack knew the Ariel by now. He knew her well, a fine, living, responsive little creature, and this was the kind of sailing he liked, driving a stout, well-found ship in a hearty blow, taking advantage of every lull, every kind run of the sea or tide, to cling to his windward gain or increase it. He had capable officers, an adequate crew, a well-tempered instrument. And in any case, he was glad to have no room for any other kind of thought at this juncture. The sight of home had troubled his mind extremely. Recollections of Amanda Smith, legal complications, self-reproach, the potential ruin of his heart, the probable shipwreck of his fortune, all these things pell-mell in a confusion of distress. He kept the Ariel under close-reefed topsails, not to outrun the poor transports, with their load of misery, their hundreds of seasick soldiers below, and their ungainly build. But he could have carried more. Although the little black stormy petrels fluttered on either hand, the breeze was still something short of a fresh gale, and in spite of the heavy seas on the larboard bow, he was convinced that he was gaining half a point. The only trouble was the impenetrable thickness of the weather. There would not be the least possibility of an observation today or tonight, nor in all likelihood for some time to come. Before darkness they passed a ship of the line and two frigates on the opposite tack, on their way to the Brest blockade, Achilles, Euterpe, Boadicea. They exchanged numbers, private signals, and greetings, and Jack looked long and intently after them, particularly the Boadicea. He had commanded her in the Indian Ocean, and he retained a strong affection for the broad-beamed, comfortable ship, slow perhaps, but so reliable once one knew her ways. Standing on a carronade slide, his arms round a stay, the heavy rain and the flying water beating on his back, he watched her tearing along, all possible canvas abroad to keep up with the swift-sailing Achilles. Mitchell had her now. He had added iron stern davits and a quarter-deck carronade on each side, but he had hardly altered her paintwork at all, the true Nelson checker. And she still had that odd, fetching, slightly hesitant second lift before she shouldered a heavy sea down her side.
"I shall not crack on like that, however," he reflected. "Festino lento, does it, as Stephen would say?" And, "God help the inshore squadron on a night like this," he added, remembering his own time off the Black Rocks and Camaret, the iron-bound coast of Brittany.
They were blotted out by another squall, coming more from the south this time, and then it was night. A black night, full of rain and shattered salt water, that showed bright as it swept over the binnacle lights and the stern lanterns, the only light in the darkness. A darkness that enveloped the whole ship as she stretched, close-hauled, for the Lizard, over a sea visible only as it broke white over the bows. The routine of the ship carried on, of course. Dim figures relieved the watch, relieved the wheel, relieved the lookouts, made their way groping along the manlines to strike the bell, heaved the log and recorded the result, huddled carefully over the folding boards in the companionway. After an hour, when he judged he might have the Lizard fine on the starboard bow 5 miles away, he made the night signal that told the transports to wear in succession, put the ship about, and hauled his wind on the other tack. When he had seen them all round in good order, the string of lights heading southward on the long leg that might, with luck, carry them round Ushant into the Bight of Biscay, he went below. Young Fenton had the deck. No Phoenix, perhaps, but a steady, reliable officer, and in any case the situation called for no extraordinary exertions, no extraordinary talents. There was nothing unusual about a westerly gale in the mouth of the channel, however wet.
"What of the night?" asked Stephen again.
"Oh," said Jack, shedding water in every direction, "it is rather moist. But if this is all the blow Pellworm prated about, it don't amount to much. We could carry whole topsails if we chose, and earth don't groan from shore to shore, not with whole topsails, you know. We wore ship not long ago, and a close hauled on the starboard tack."
"Will that bring us clear of Ushant, do you suppose?"
"It might, if only the breeze would keep due west. But I'm afraid it will back a point or two. We may have to run up to the Sillies to make our westing. Still, we shall see in the morning," said Jack, throwing off his outer clothes and settling in the swinging chair.
"If we are spared," said Stephen, "there is a horrid roar outside, and wet is creeping in."
"That is only the ship hauling under the chains with the swell. I dare say it is blowing great guns off the Azores, but here it does little more than make the passengers a trifle queasy, and increase our leeway by perhaps a point."
He yawned, stated that the glass was rising, repeated that they should see tomorrow, and went fast to sleep. For once Captain Aubrey spoke too soon. They did not see tomorrow. Tomorrow there was nothing to be seen but even heavier rain, even more spray and spindrift, a narrow horizon of high, spiky waves, and dimly the transports, still in accurate line astern. No sun, no hint of the sun at all, and the dead reckoning of the ships differed by 40 miles. Once again they wore, and once again they ran north through the obscure confusion of elements. The day, such as it was, and the night were repetitions of those that had gone before. To those used to the sea it was not particularly dramatic, little more than thick and dirty weather in the western approaches, but for the landsmen it was an unending present, filled with meaningless noise and motion, and for many with seasickness as well. From Ushant to Scilly it is 35 leagues, they were told, and it seemed to them that they must have traversed each one of those leagues many, many times, with short intervals for brief, ill-dressed meals. And in the end boredom overcame terror, except now and then when a more than usually heavy lee-lurch sent them flying about the deck. Even Jagiello sank into a kind of dismal torpor. The fore and main hatches had been laid long since, and although a good deal of water came in through the Ariel's sides because of her working, very little fresh air joined it. It was long since hammocks had been piped up, and as the hard-working hands were not washed by anything but the rain, since they had no means of washing apart from tubs on the now impracticable deck, and then only for their hands and faces, they and their damp, close-packed beds filled the unventilated tween decks with a strong, all-pervading smell of frosty carnivores, far worse than the collection of vegetarian marsupials Stephen had carried from New Holland in an earlier voyage. He was used to it, however. Human filth in foul weather had been with him from his first days in the Navy. He saw little of Jack Aubrey, but that little was always cheerful and generally hungry. Once he reported that a favourable shift of the wind had brought them well to the west of the Scillies, and once he said that a fleeting glimpse of some star had confirmed him in his persuasion that the next leg would do it. But most of his time below was spent in sleep. From this sleep he was aroused after a very late and scrappy dinner by the signal midshipman, a tall, thin, dark, conscientious youth, who instantly said in a voice trembling with excitement,
"Mr. Crimmins' duty, sir, and 2 sail to windward. One is Jason and t'other a French 2-decker.
"Very good, Mr. Mears. I shall be on deck directly. In the meantime, make the private signal and our number. But first, pray pass me my sou'wester."
On deck, all eyes were fixed to windward, staring into a particularly heavy downpour. For a moment Jack saw nothing, but then the rain swept over them, and beyond, the veil lifted, and there on the larboard quarter lay the 2 ships, steering southeast, with the wind at west, racing along in a white turmoil of their own making. The position was clear. The French ship was certainly running for Brest, and the Jason was certainly in chase. Whether the Jason would ever come up with her was another matter. They were at least 2 miles apart, much too far for the Jason's bow chasers to reduce the Frenchman's speed by knocking away a spar, and the Jason, right in the Frenchman's wake, had already spread all the canvas she could possibly bear with safety, probably even more, whereas the Chase still had a reef on her topsails. The Jason's only hope was chancing upon an English cruiser, or the blockading squadron in with the land. The Ariel was not cruising, nor was she a cruiser at all where an enemy line of battleship was concerned, but by instantly putting her head southeastwards and by carrying a press of sail, she might cut the line between the Chase and Brest at some time in the late afternoon. She might possibly delay her long enough for the Jason to come up. On the other hand, there were his transports. There were his direct orders.
"Jason signalling, sir," said Mears, his telescope to his eye. "Enemy in sight, and she gives the bearing."
Jack smiled. He had seen some foolish signals in his time, but few as inept as this.
"Again, sir, haul your wind on the starboard tack, and now chase to the southeast."
"Acknowledge," said Jack.
"Again, sir, make more sail."
And 5 miles away, a puff of smoke appeared momentarily on the Jason's leeward quarter as she emphasized the order with a gun. Jack smiled once more. Middleton, and Middleton had the Jason now, had always been very talkative. Yet Middleton was junior to him. Middleton could not know it. He could not know that for the moment the Ariel, a sloop, was commanded by a post-captain. But in fact, Joe Middleton had no right to be giving orders. This was no time for formalizing, however. It was a time for decision. Instant decision. If he were to act at all, it must be now. In this heavy sea, the Ariel could not sail as fast as a two-decker. In order to cross the enemy's line, or even to reach a point within the short range of the Ariel's carronades before nightfall, he would have to take advantage of every cable's length of advance he possessed. Even at this point, even at the point the Frenchman had already reached, the angle was critically fine. These thoughts passed through his mind with great rapidity as he stood mechanically assessing the speed and course of the ships far to windward, the strength of the southwest wind, the send of the sea, the possibility of useful intervention. Before the remote thump of the Jason's gun reached them, his decision was clear in his mind. He was only sorry he had no time to send Stephen and Colonel Dullestrett aboard the transports. He said,
"All hands to wear ship!"
And he noticed a general look of pleasure on the quarterdeck, nods and grins exchanged. Fulfilling these young men's expectation of him had formed no part of his calculations, but he was glad they were pleased. He reached for the azimuth compass, carefully took the bearings of both ships, and said,
"Mr. Mears, to Jason, steer south 27 east, then alphabetical, Aubrey. Another hoist, and keep it flying. Enemy in sight! Chase to southwest."
That should cut Middleton's cackle, but infinitely more important than that, it might win him half a mile or so. There was a strong likelihood that the Frenchman could read the signal, and in any case, the sight of the Ariel wearing out of the line would almost certainly make him head farther south for a while. At this distance, and in this visibility, the Ariel, though clearly a single-decked ship, might be a frigate, even a heavy frigate, with a bite worse than her bark. Furthermore, her signal to friends beyond the Frenchman's horizon might be true. It might bring half the offshore squadron pelting down.
"Mr. Grimmond," he said, "lay me under the Mirza's lee."
The Mirza being the senior troop carrier. Then, with the Ariel's main topsail backed, he took a speaking trumpet and roared through the wind,
"Mr. Smithson, rendezvous in the Bordeaux stream. If I'm not there, report to the senior officer, Santandero. Go easy, carry nothing away, no royals, no kites."
"Never you fear for us, sir,"
called Smithson, waving his capable right hand.
"Good luck to you."
The transports knew perfectly well what was afoot, and they gave the Ariel a hearty cheer as she filled and passed down the line.
"Course southeast by east to half east," said Jack, with the French ship firm in his glass. "Shake out the foretopsail reef."
Through the murk and the flying spray, he caught the movement as the Chase braced up, bringing the wind before the beam as he had expected, veering southward from the danger, perhaps the very serious danger, in the northeast. But even so, it would be a near-run thing, he reflected, as he stared at the white sails under the low grey sky. and the chase must be making 9 or even 10 knots, and if he failed to cross her forefoot, if he merely fetched her wake, his intervention, brief as it must necessarily be, would prove of little use. Little use, but quite as dangerous.
"Mr. Mears," he said, "pray be so good as to ask Jason for her position and repeat it to the transports."
A long pause, caused partly by the difficulty of seeing flags through 5 miles of haze and rain in a thin grey light, and partly by hesitancy aboard the Jason.
"No observation 3 days," said Mears at last. "Estimate 49 degrees 27 minutes north, 7 degrees 10 minutes west. Chronometer 5 hours 28 minutes past noon.
As he checked the difference between Stephen's watch and the Jason's, a pretty wide variation, Jack smiled again. Middleton was no scientific sailor. Boredom in the smoke was more his line, but he or his master could not be very far out in the longitude, and that meant the Frenchman had no possibility of fetching La Rochelle with this wind. It was Brest or Lorient for him, unless he chose to run for Cherbourg, through a channel filled with English squadrons. A fine ship, he thought, gazing over the ocean. She was as close-hauled as she could be, yet she was throwing an enormous bow wave half down her side. The aerial would have to spread more canvas if she were to come up with any time and space for manoeuvre, and a ship of the aerial's size needed plenty of both if she were to do anything at all to a 74.
"Pass the word for the boatswain," he said,
and when the dripping boatswain came plunging aft from the forecastle,
"Mr. Graves, let us get light hawsers to the mastheads as briskly as we can."
"Hawsers to the mastheads, sir?" said the boatswain, amazed.
"Yes, Mr. Graves,"
said Jack pleasantly, ducking under the perfect deluge of sea-water that came over the weather rail.
"I should like to see them all set up before the last dog watch. I doubt we shall beat to divisions today."
The boatswain smiled, as in duty bound. He said,
"Aye, aye, sir. Light hawsers to the mastheads it is,"
in a low, wondering tone, and padded off.
"Mr. Graves," called Jack after him, "be sure to let them take the wet before you set them up taut. We must not ring the masts."
It was an operation he had used with much success. The great extra strength of the hawsers would allow him to set to gansels without the masts complaining, or infinitely worse, carrying away, and although it could not be done in a crank ship because of the increased top hamper, the aerial was by no means crank, but admirably stiff. The greater thrust, the greater speed had kept him alive before this, particularly when he was flying before a wicked Dutchman in the high southern latitudes, and obviously it would answer the other way about. He wondered the practice was not more generally known. The hawsers were not to the mastheads before the last dog watch, nor anything like it. Squall after squall of very heavy rain swept down on the sloop, rain so thick that fresh water gushed from the lee scuppers, and the hands could hardly tell what they were at, while at the same time the turning gusts within the squalls knocked her about most brutally, taking her aback 3 times, and making it impossible to keep her steady on her course. The French ship and the Jason vanished entirely for the best part of an hour.
"Should I feel better if I were to vomit?" asked Jagiello. "I doubt it," said Stephen. "It has done nothing for the Colonel."
The pursued and the pursuer were still there, in their expected positions, when the last squall passed away into the dark northeast, blotting out the horizon to leeward, but leaving the sea clear to starboard. The Frenchman was still reaching as far south as ever he could, veering from the imaginary danger. He had not yet discovered the cheat. But he had set a forestaysail, he had let out his remaining reefs, and he had gained perceptibly on the Jason. On the other hand, his course and the aerials were converging, although the sloop kept the wind a whole point free for greater speed. The chase was nearer by 1/2 mile, and clearer by far.
"She is the Méduse," said Hyde.
"Then let us hope we may trim her locks with Jason's help,"
said Jack at once, and he laughed aloud. His spirits were at a fine, tearing pitch. He felt extremely well. Even if it had been remembered, nothing on land had the least importance. Yet beneath the glow of well-being, his mind continually worked upon the changing factors, upon the 3 visible moving points of the triangle, and the unseen variables that would affect them. And beneath the eagerness there was a clear-headed realization of the danger of his present course. Although he intended no more than a hit-and-run delaying action, it meant bringing his stumpy carronades well within the reach of the Frenchman's far-reaching long guns, with a broadside of at least 840 pounds, as opposed to his 265. In moderate weather, with her lower tier of gun ports open, the Méduse would certainly sink the aerial at a mile, destroying her before she could open an effectual fire. Even in these circumstances, there was a fair possibility that none of these cheerful young men around him would live until tomorrow. Everything depended upon speed.
"Hawsers to the masthead, sir," said the boatswain.
"Very good, Mr. Graves," said Jack. "You have done very well."
A rapid survey and back to the quarterdeck.
"Hands to make sail," he called.
"A whale aloft. Lay out. Let fall."
And raising his voice to carry half a mile, wind or no wind,
"Fore-to-gallant halyards there! Handsomely now, handsomely! A fathom, and a fathom! Up she rises! Tally and belay!"
One after another, the sails rose slowly up on their yards, each ballooning wildly to leeward at first, and each gradually brought to a fine, taut curve. Smoothly and evenly, the full strain of the far greater thrust came to the powerful hawsers, and as each sail filled, the aerial took on a greater heel, so that with the third her deck was at the slope of a moderately high-pitched roof, while her larboard cathead and much of her lee rail vanished under a smother of white foam. Jack hooked himself onto a weather backstay and reached aft for the hawser that trebled its power. Taut, but not iron-taut, nowhere near its breaking strain.
"Mr. Hyde," he said, smiling at his lieutenant's anxious face, "let us try the log. We may be making close on 11 knots.
11 knots and 2 fathoms, sir," came the reply, delivered by a delighted midshipman, his red face shining as he scrambled up the slope from the leeward side.
11 knots was very well, but the Méduse was a new ship, a beautiful sailer like so many of the Frenchmen, and well handled. And once she brought the wind a point free, she would move even faster.
He would probably cross her path by sunset at the present rate, but he would be far happier with something more, with a time in hand to lie on her bow, cross her stem, and wear, hitting her twice before he ran.
"I believe we may venture upon a main topmast staysail," he said.
The staysail was sheeted home. It took 30 men to bring the sheet right aft, and the aerial heeled another 7 degrees.
"How strangely the floor is sloping," said Jagiello. "I can hardly sit in my chair. What do you suppose they are doing?"
"I cannot tell," said Stephen. "It is a melancholy reflection that the passenger is a mere helpless, unhelpful parcel when the tempest roars. Does not the captain seek your advice, sir?"
"Not always," said Stephen.
The rain had stopped. The captain and the gunner had made a tour of the sloop's armament. Returning to the quarter-deck, Jack said,
"The rain has stopped for the moment. Perhaps the doctor would like to see how the sloop is coming along. Mr. Rowbottom, pray jump below and tell him, with my compliments, that we are making 12 knots, and that if he would like to see, now is the time. It may come on to blow presently."
"The captain's compliments, sir," said Rowbottom, "and we are making 12 knots.
12 knots, sir!"
"Why?" asked Stephen.
"To catch the Méduse, sir. She is on our starboard beam," said Rowbottom. "A French 74, sir," he added, seeing incomprehension before him, "and we hope to trim her locks directly with Jason's help. Jason is only 2 miles astern and coming down like thunder."
"Dear me, is there to be a battle?" cried Stephen. "I had no idea at all."
"A battle?" cried Jagiello, his torpor vanishing. "May I come too?"
After a first wild flurry that would have flung them into the lee scuppers, if not into the Atlantic, but for the powerful arm of the quartermaster at the conn, they were made fast to stanchions on the weather quarter, well out of the way.
"I thought you would like to see the position," said Jack,
and he outlined it in a mild roar.
"And I thought you would like to see what the ship can do when she is put to her shifts."
"Sure, this is speed itself," cried Stephen, the foam flying past his face. "The racing exhilaration of—"
He had been going to say of Icarus before his fall, but he checked himself, preferring
"a swooping elegance, an appearance of extreme danger just averted, a falcon's flight, so it is."
"She is a sweet creature," said Jack. "I am glad you have seen her at her best. Now is the time, because we shall be busy in half an hour, and,
Nodding into the black, tormented west, a darkness shot through and through with hidden lightning.
"It will come on to blow tonight. Pellworm's blow, I dare say. We are forward-reaching on her, as you see, and we mean to haul our wind, shoot up, cross her stem, rake her, wear, and rake her again, and fly for our lives before she can yaw. We are twice as nimble, you know, and with our carronades we can fire twice as fast."
He moved off to measure the angles with his sextant, and Jagiello said into Stephen's ear,
"That ship looks three times as large as the Ariel." "It is, as I understand, four times the size," said Stephen. "But the disproportion is not as great as you might suppose, since, as you perceive, their lower range of guns on this side are buried beneath the waves, because of her lean, or list, whereas ours are all raised well above the surface. I have known Captain Aubrey attack at even greater odds and succeed."
"When will the battle begin?"
"In about half an hour, I am told. I shall fetch my sword and my pistols."
In fact, it began far sooner. The Méduse suddenly bore up, as though to pass under the Ariel's stern and destroy her. Jack at once hauled his wind, and the ships converged at a shocking speed under the low, grey, racing sky. He would still have just time to cross the Frenchman's stem if he were not knocked out first. Nearer, nearer, fine on the Méduse's larboard bow. Nearer still, almost within reach of the carronades.
"Fire at a word! Fire high! Aim at her tops!"
he called again down the tense line of waiting gun crews. The Méduse yawed to port at last, and let fly with her upper deck guns, a well-grouped broadside but a trifle high. They heard the scream of iron overhead, shriller than the wind, and then the huge thunder. Nearer still.
"Fire!"
said Jack, and the Ariel's starboard carronades replied at the limit of their range. A staysail ripped loose aboard the Frenchman and tore to pieces, flapping down the wind. The Ariels cheered as they reloaded with furious speed, but now the Méduse's lower ports were opening and the great guns running out, free of the water on the upward roll as she came tearing down on the Ariel's beam.
"Fire!"
cried Jack again. The two broadsides bawled out at the same moment, and the Ariel's for topmast went by the board, cut clean away. Her foreyard parted at the slings, and she shot up into the wind, spinning fast on her heel.
"Larboard guns!"
roared Jack, ignoring the chaos, the wild confusion of sailcloth and rigging and spars, and leaping for the nearest carronade himself. The quicker-witted men were with him, and as the Méduse swept past, they shattered her spanker-boom and blasted five cloths from her main course. 2 minutes later, and close on a mile away, she answered with a careful, studied discharge from her after-guns that sent solid water over the Ariel's deck and shattered the boats on the beams. Then she was out of her range, still running fast, but by no means as fast as before. They had only just managed to clear away the chief of the wreckage and get her head before the wind when the Jason came hurtling down in the Méduse's wake. She was already trying long shots with her bow chasers, and she flew the signal, "Do you require assistance?"
"Negative,"
said Jack, and they cheered one another as she went by. There followed a period of the most intense and strenuous work before the Ariel could haul to the wind again and stand on after the ships of the line, still visible in the southeast and now steadily engaging at the extremity of their range. She had a spare main-t'gallant mast at the fore, swayed up by main force and the grace of God in an impossible sea, a cross-jack yard for her forecourse, and her knotted rigging was an ugly sight. Her speed, of course, was much reduced, but she held a good wind and she limped after the great ships with a fair chance of joining the action after they had mauled each other for a while. The Jason had already lost her spritsail yard, shot away or carried away, they could not tell, and they knew what they had done to the Méduse. Both the ships of the line were travelling far more slowly.
"We are well out of that,"
said Jack, when at last he could come below in the twilight and drink a pot of tea.
"I never thought we should come off so easy. No killed or wounded, never a shot in the hull, only a few spars knocked away apart from the boats, and we clipped her locks finely. I thought she would blow us out of the water without so much as a by your leave. If she had had a moment to spare, she would certainly have done so. I've rarely been so pleased in my life as when I saw her run out of range, with her boom gone in the jaws."
"What is your present intention, Tell?" asked Stephen.
Why, we must hang on to their skirts as well as ever we can through the night, and if we cannot join in ourselves, which I don't despair of, we must try to bring down any ship within sight or hearing by blue lights and rockets and gunfire. There is a very fair chance of meeting with some of our cruisers, if not the Brest team itself.
And what of Pellworm's blow?
Oh, damn Pellworm and his blow! We must cross that bridge when we come to it. For the moment our duty is to follow. But first I'm going to have a bite. Will you join me in a cold leg of mutton?
Following was easy enough in the first part of the night. Not only did the Jason carry an unusually powerful toplight, but even when it was hidden by the rain and the low racing clouds, the gun flashes showed where they were. The aerial followed after them in an effulgence of blue lights, with frequent guns and rockets twice at every bell, and at one time she was certainly gaining on them. This was at the beginning of the middle watch, when the whole southeastern sky was lit not by the single flash of chasers, but by the blaze of full broadsides, six times repeated, broadsides whose thunder reached them over the howling of the gale, and reached them within two heartbeats of the blaze. But then no more. No gleam, no flash, all swallowed up in a driving, pelting rain so thick that men ducked their heads to breathe, rain borne almost flat across the deck by a wind whose voice in the rigging and over the torn sea rose to such a pitch that it would have drowned any broadside beyond half a mile. At first they thought it was a squall, but it lasted. All night it lasted, and they were obliged to admit they had utterly lost sight of the Jason and her chase.
"Never mind," said Jack. "We shall see them to windward at break of day."
Always providing the Méduse had not put before the wind for Cherbourg, he added to himself, for by his reckoning, based on Jason's position some hours before, she should have reached the best point for a run up mid-channel, with no great risk of interception on a night as dirty as this.
"Should you not turn in, sir?" suggested Hyde, diffidently. "You've been on deck since the beginning, as well as most of last night. There is nothing we can do, with the sky as dark as pitch, and we have 200 miles under our lee."
"I believe I shall, Hyde," said Jack. "Keep her just so."
The ship was under lower staysails, reefed forecourse and mizzen, heading southeast, plunging along through a very heavy sea, the wind steady in the west-southwest.
"And let me be called at daylight, or if anything should happen before."
It was dirty weather, very dirty weather, but the aerial was a fine, tight, weatherly little ship, a good sea-boat, and she could deal with worse than this, in spite of her jury for topmast. Rarely had he slept so deep. He had hardly thrown off his jacket before his eyes were closing. As he lay down, he could hear himself breathing, perhaps snoring, for a moment, and then he was gone. Gone into a strangely vivid dream, in which some fool was shaking him and bawling into his ear, "Breakers under the lee!" "Breakers under the lee, sir!" shouted Hyde again.
"Christ!"
said Jack, instantly awake. He leapt from his cot and sprang up on deck, Hyde following with his jacket. There in the greyness, neither night nor yet day, white water showed broad on the larboard beam, an enormous sea breaking on a vast shoal of rocks 2 cables' lengths away. The ship was still close-hauled on the starboard tack, although she was making a fair headway, the wind, the swell, and the making tide were all heaving her in towards the reef, broadside on. She would never stay out against such a wind, even if her foretopmast were sound. He could not tack, but there was still just room to wear.
"Hands about ship! Hard aport!"
he said, and no more. The officers and men flew to their duty. The after-sails vanished, the ship paid off to leeward, faster and faster towards the reef, turned on its very edge, turned through 20 points, and came up beautifully on the larboard tack heading north-northwest.
"Luff and touch her," Jack said to the man at the wheel. "Shiver the main course."
He wanted no strong headway until he knew where he was. They were either right on Ushant or the French mainland. In either case, his reckoning had set him 50 miles north of his true position and far to the east, but it was essential to know which. Staring to leeward, he could scarcely make out more than the dark loom of land through the rain. Yet at least he did see that Hyde had done all that was proper aboard. The carpenter and his crew stood by with axes to cut away the masts. In the bows the anchors were cleared away and ready a cockbill. The lead was going in the main chains. Rapid casts, no chant, the depth instantly given.
6! 1/4 less 5!
"Breakers ahead!" roared the forecastle lookout.
Jack ran forward, surveyed the long line of fast-appearing white, a second reef that barred their path to the west and the north, their way to the open sea, an unbroken line that seemed to end in a dim headland away to starboard. The reef grew clearer, and he saw rollers breaking far out into the offing, a great breadth of mortal surf.
"Fill the main course," he called. "One point to starboard."
The aerial ran on straight for the white water. As he gauged the distance and the force of the wind, listening intently to the leadsman, the hands on the forecastle turned their anxious faces to his, with total reliance in his judgment. 50 yards from the turmoil, he called,
"Hard a weather!"
The aerial shot up into the wind, paused in 4 fathoms, and he said,
"Let go the best bower,"
just as sternway came on her. The anchor held. She gently veered out a cable and rode there between the 2 reefs, bowing the sea and the tide, a strong tide near the top of the flood. It was a respite, but if they were where he suspected, it could not last long. He sent to rouse Stephen, Jagiello, and the colonel, called for a double guard on the spirit room for seamen loved to die drunk, ordered the galley fires to be lit. Some of the aerial's people were badly frightened, as well they might be, and an appearance of order would comfort them, to say nothing of hot burgoo in their bellies. Already the day was coming, with light over the land. The rain stopped abruptly, the thick haze swept off the sea, and he knew where he was. It was worse than he had thought. They were in what the Navy called Gripes Bay, deep in Gripes Bay. The aerial had somehow contrived to make her way between the 2 main reefs in the night, never touching any of the countless rocks that lay scattered between them. It was a vile bay, open to the southwest, never frequented by the ships of the inshore squadron, bad holding ground for anchors, ugly sharp rocks to cut cables, reefs wherever you looked. But he knew its waters well from fishing expeditions in small craft during calm weather when he was on the Brest blockade. And as a 17-year-old master's mate, he had commanded the Resolution's yawl when the boats of the squadron stormed the Camaret battery. He looked over the taffrail, and there was the battery itself, a short mile away, a fort high perched above the north end of the reef. It had been repaired, of course, and presently the soldiers would wake up and open fire. Beyond Camaret lay Brest, at the bottom of the bay, the village of Tregonec, with its little half-moon jetty round the fisherman's harbour, at the mouth of the stream, and another strong fort. No lying there between 2 fires, although the shore was calm enough, protected as it was by such massive reefs, no great surf on the beach, even with such an enormous sea beating outside. But southwards there was the other horn of the bay, Gripes Point, and round Gripes Point lay Salvation, the beautiful great bight of Douarnenez, where a whole squadron could lie, sheltered from the south and west, and laughing at the French batteries, too far off to do any harm. To get there he would have to work round the point. The only way of doing so was to run south, skirting the inner reef, towards the rock they called the Thatcher, close in by the southern arm of the bay, and then to go about, make a short board towards the outer reef, and so round Gripes Point into safety, there to lie until the gale blew itself out, and a falling tide enabled them to run clear. There was not the least possibility of weathering the outer reef, of running through the gap at present, with the wind dead on shore. He hoped to God they would be able to go about well before the Thatcher, while there was still room to wear, for there was no question of tacking right down there, where the thrust of the sea, unbroken by the outer reef, was so very much greater. But he could decide on the point of turn only when he was much nearer. In the meantime, there was the question of rocks and shoals in their path.
"Do any of you gentlemen know this bay?"
he asked the quarterdeck. They looked at one another, a general blankness. But before any could reply, they were soaked with flying water. The fort had opened fire, and the first shot pitched no more than 6 feet wide of the starboard main chains.
"Cut the cable," said Jack. "Port your helm."
The ship gathered sternway, turning as she went. The backed jib filled, followed by the hard-braced topsails, and after an infinitesimal pause of no motion, she began to surge forward, faster and faster still, through a fresh downpour from the offing. Jack set her down the channel between the inner reef and the outer, and in spite of the shot falling all round them, he reduced sail.
"Cast quick! Cast quick!"
he called to the leadsman. He must not run plump onto a rock or a minor reef. A ricochet from the fort knocked the ensign staff away and skipped through the mizzen topsail.
"Colours to a whip in the leeward shrouds, Mr. Hyde," he said without looking astern. "How I hate being fired at from the shore," he muttered.
But at least this fire was not as accurate as some he had known from French batteries. For the short time it lasted, the rainstorm almost entirely hid the aerial, and the artillerymen pointed their pieces at random. On. Cautiously on. He was beginning to recover the whole feel of the bay. On the starboard beam there was a rock where they used to catch gurnards, and on the bow the cluster of islets where they took crayfish at low tide, a white mass of breakers now. Presently they would pass the gap in the inner reef that the fishermen used. The spring tide would be flowing in at a furious rate. He hauled up a point to anticipate its thrust, and as the leadsman's voice rose to a scream,
"Mark three! Mark three!"
the aerial struck in the trough of a wave, a long, deep, grinding crash that made her check and stagger in her pace, trembling from stem to stern. Then she was off, running smoothly, and the leadsman cried,
"Mark five! Mark five! Deep six and a half six!"
A long, dark piece of her false keel showed in the wild water to larboard, turning and rearing as it ran through the gap to the distant shore. Grimmond hurried below.
"Cast quick! Cast quick!" said Jack again. "Cast well ahead!"
"Aye, aye, sir,"
said the leadsman, and he whirled his long, heavy plummet in an even wider circle before shooting it out. They were out of the battery's range, and presently they would be out of the shelter of the outer reef. Its southern extremity was the point he must reach in order to wear round and run into the shelter, the safety of Douarnenez Bay. Once he had reached that southern end, there would be no difficulty. But of course he could only reach it close-hauled on the larboard tack, and as they ran it became more and more evident that the beginning of the turn must lie far along, right down by the Thatcher itself. Nothing short of the Thatcher would bring them out. That meant there would be no room to wear, nothing remotely like it, scarcely even room to club-haul her, a perilous manoeuvre at the best of times, and here he would have to judge it to the yard. With such a wind and sea and among such rocks, there would be no correcting any error, and the Thatcher was no great way off.
"All's well below, sir," said the master, coming from the hold. "A couple of foot in the forepeak, no more."
Jack nodded. That was very far from well in such a dry ship at ordinary times, but now it did not signify.
"Mr. Hyde," he said, "I'm going to club-haul the ship when we reach that tall black and white rock. Let the sheet anchor be cleared away. Men with axes to stand by."
Then, raising his voice to a hoarse shout that carried over the gale,
"Aerials! We are going about, club-hauled, when we reach the height of the Thatcher! Let every man obey the word of command on the instant, and with God's help we weather the point and ride snug into Douarnenez Bay. A mistake, and we drive on the rock. Do nothing until you are told, but then do it like lightning!"
The men nodded, looking very grave, but quite confident. He saw with pleasure that not one of them had got at the spirit room. Now the ship was far out of the shelter of the offshore reef, and she took the full force of the sea and the gale. At this pace, and he had to bear sail, the Thatcher was 5 minutes away. 4 minutes away. The white water towering up its sheer side in solemn, thunderous, long-spaced fountains.
"What does he mean by club haul?"
asked Jagiello, clinging to the rail by Stephen's side.
"He means to drop the anchor, stop the ship's motion with its head to the wind, cut the rope, and go off in the other direction, a short way out to sea and so round the cape."
"The rock is very close. The leadsman says there is a proper depth. Hear him."
"Luff!"
cried Jack, his eyes fixed on the Thatcher and the drifting kelp.
"Up, staysail sheets!"
And after an unbearable 5 seconds,
"Let go the anchor!"
All at once her bowsprit was pointing straight into the roaring gale, though the heavy seas tried to force her head to leeward.
"Up, main tack! Haul of all! Cut!"
The axe flashed down on the cable. She was almost round in the balance. Already she had a prodigious sternway moving straight for the Thatcher.
"Fetch a cast aft! Far aft!"
cried Jack to the leadsman, leaning out over the quarter-rail to judge the last possible moment, the greatest possible impetus for the full starboard helm that would bring her right round. The leadsman turned, swung with all his might. The lead line caught the bellying ensign whip. The lead shot inboard, struck Jack down on the deck. On his hands and knees, through the crash of the blow and the roar of the sea, he heard Hyde's voice at an infinite distance shout, "Larboard all! I mean starboard!" Then an all-embracing thunder as the aerial struck the Thatcher full on, beating her rudder and staving in much of her stern. He was on his feet, a momentary glimpse of Hyde's appalled, deathly face, and he saw the ship broadside on to the sea.
"Brail up! Clew up, mizzen and main! Foresail sheets aft!"
he cried. Grinding and grinding again over rock, the good Ariel brought her head right before the wind, and he drove her over the narrowest part of the inner reef with what steering the foresail alone would provide. He was still at a great distance, very far removed, but all his mind that was clear felt with the ship, and after the seventh great shattering strike, he knew her back was broken amidships. Yet with spring tide near its height she did not hold fast, but drove on and on through breakers that reared up to her tops. In the calmer water beyond the reef she still swam, she still steered, but it could not last long.
"Guns overboard!" he said.
With their weight gone she would stay afloat long enough for him to run her ashore. A few minutes later, with the wind and the sea and the tide heaving her in towards the mouth of the river, he told the officers to fetch their commissions and see to their affairs. Then he beckoned Stephen and they went below. The water was already shin-deep in the cabin.
"The colonel must shift into a marine's uniform and pass for a private," he said. "Do you agree?"
Stephen nodded. Jack said,
"I will give the order."
And he gathered up the lead-covered signal book, his dispatches and private papers, and his sword, told the steward to pack what he could, and went back on deck. He threw the signal book, his dispatches, and his sword overboard, spoke to the marine officer about the colonel, and returned to steering the poor, heavy wreck to the shore. For some reason he was perfectly confident that she would not go to pieces, but would bring them to land, and she behaved beautifully to the last. A final heave on the starboard sheet brought her wallowing up against the jetty at the height of the tide, with the water gurgling at her hatches. All they had to do was to step over the rail to the waiting company of soldiers and the small, silent crowd.